but there are wines that are art, and I would like to bring people's attention to that by, if that is by making art in reaction to that art, I think that's that could be the a way that I would contribute.
Welcome to Season 2. We bring another great season of the Abwazi Wine Buzz podcast, and we're really excited to have you here with us. We have an impressive lineup of guests from all over the globe and from different and very interesting walks of life. They will reveal and share their perspective, deep thoughts, dynamic insights on life, wine, and etiquette. Not to be missed, so join us on another intriguing journey. Today, it gives me enormous pleasure to interview Sarah Heller, who is a master of wine, but I think she's so much more than that. That's one of her titles, but you'll discover very soon who and what Sarah Heller is and what I see as enormous potential for the years ahead. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lee, for that glowing introduction. Really appreciate it.
Sarah, if one were to ask you what possible grape varietals there are in an Amarone, I don't think you would have any problem in rattling off the names Corvina, Rondinella, Corvain, and a few other permitted varieties. Now, if Sarah Heller was a prestigious wine, and I'm sure she is, and you were asked, what is your makeup? What is your soul? What is your background, your roots? Could you share more with our viewers?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would have to be a great variety that that has traveled a great deal of distance and probably doesn't really know entirely where it is at home and manages to do well, I hope, in a couple of different environments. It's ironic because when you first asked the question, I was thinking to myself, Nebbiolo, but if it has to be something that's really like me, Nebbiolo is one that's so at home in Piemonte and really doesn't thrive anywhere else. So I think that would be not the ideal choice, perhaps. I don't know, like
but
maybe a bit more like
you.
Syrah.
Tell us about you. Where your background?
Thank you. Yeah, so I was born and raised in Hong Kong, but as you can see, I'm not there at the moment. In fact, I moved in the early part of last year to the Pacific Northwest, which is actually where my dad grew up. So my dad is half Hong Kong Chinese and half German, Irish, different things. But he grew up in the Pacific Northwest, which even then was already a very international community. And he grew up in Seattle. We're near Seattle now. And when my husband and I, we felt that it was time to move somewhere else, partly for our kids. We wanted our kids to have a little bit more, I think the same reasons that a lot of people have for leaving Hong Kong. We just wanted them to have a little bit more space. And so as we were looking at that, we had a lot of choices because he's from New Zealand. He had the right to be in Australia. We could have ended up in Europe somewhere, but we liked that the Pacific Northwest still has a bit of a connection to Asia. But it's in the US, which is I'm actually American, even though I was born overseas. So it's been an ambition for some time to make moves into this market as well.
So you are in many senses of the word, a hybrid. You've got some,
indeed,
you know, mm-hmm. and with that comes the linguistic skills.
Thank you. Well,
languages.
I love languages. I didn't know that when I was a kid growing up. I actually, ironically, despite having been born in Hong Kong, I grew up with English and German because my dad is part German. I went to the German Swiss school. And so that was always very confusing for people, especially, you know, taxi drivers, other people, because I look Cantonese enough. I would always respond in very broken Cantonese, if at all. But with time, when I was in school, later on, I learned Mandarin. And then when I was in university, I decided that I wanted to spend more time in Europe. And so I'd always had the idea that I would like to speak a lot of European languages, but didn't really think it was feasible to just pick them up. But I found Rosetta Stone, just showing my age a little bit. There was no Duolingo yet, but and yeah, spent the summer 1 year learning French, the next time learning Italian, and yeah, then obviously being immersed in the cultures is very helpful for really getting in depth on the language skills.
I don't think it's revealing your age. I'm also a Rosetta Stone fan and disciple.
Fantastic,
Yeah, so
fantastic.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Now, you're located just north or south of Seattle?
Actually, just east. So we're on an island. I'm not there
Oh.
right now. We're actually in the mountains, but I'm on an island in the middle of Lake Washington.
Okay. Well, that's quite a journey that you've taken, Sarah. Now, I see you as a sort of new wave, the changing of the guard. And with it, there has to be changes themselves. Could you share with us some of your reviews of wine, for example, with the Tatler Champagne Asian Guide that you've just completed, please?
Thank you. Thank you. So the idea, I mean, I think wine criticism, right, has been, I think, more widely accepted on an international scale in the wake of Robert Parker, right? He's led the way in terms of what people think a wine review is supposed to be. 100 points. Obviously, there are other critics, especially in the UK, like Jancis, who use 20 points. But I think for a lot of consumers, both in the Asian market and in the American market especially, 100 points is it. And I actually have gone down that path at this point with Clubbing Logique. But with Tatler, which was really the champagne guide that we created, was really something new from my tenure there. And I wanted to do something that was less about telling people with a sort of somewhat objective number, like this is great, this is not great. I wanted to give people an idea of what the styles were like. I think to highlight the fact that there is so much more stylistic diversity in champagne now than there was, and there's always been more than people realize that there was. So what I did was we started using these shapes to describe shapes and colors to describe the wines. So the shape that I've come up with that I think is a little bit confusing for people to understand, but I'm keeping pressing ahead with it is the idea of a lens, right? So a wine that's sort of tight to begin with, fills out on the middle and then is sharp again to finish. I think so many champagnes have that shape. But the ones that have more Pinot Noir, for example, tend to have wider shoulders. So I think of those more like a rectangle. Pinot Meunier, maybe more oval shaped, but a classic Chardonnay-driven champagne, I think are the classic lens shape. And then we talked about the colors, not so much in terms of the color of the wine, but the color spectrum of the flavors, right? Are these more golden flavors? Are they greener flavors? Is there even like a bit of pink in the flavor? So that was sort of the idea with that.
You know, as you were describing, you know, the broadness and then the concentration and the focus, I could envisage that very, very clearly. And, you know, I think there is a time and there is a place for people like Robert Parker,
Absolutely.
James Suckling. They all have their niche, but there's a new wave, there's a new descriptor that people want. I think the, as you mentioned, out of the 100 points, it becomes quite boring, actually. And there's the sense that, oh, if it's not a 90 pointer plus, then it's not worthwhile looking at. Now, I'm of the opinion that the best wine that people can try is actually the wine that they like. And it doesn't matter
Absolutely.
what anybody else says. You could pound them with the best French or Italian cruise, and it would make no difference at all. Now, what interests me is part of your studies on the, you had to write a paper for your MW, and it was on the new generation and what they looked for with e-commerce. Could you share that with us a bit more?
Absolutely, and thank you for looking into that. It's one I talked about a lot when I first got the MW, and then it hasn't come up for a while, so excited to have the opportunity. That was actually, in a way, the font of a lot of my insights, I think, into the way that younger people are thinking about wine, particularly in China, where it is, it's still a new wine market, was that people want to be given descriptors that are evocative rather than descriptive per se, right? So they don't, telling somebody this wine tastes like strawberries and raspberries, especially, I mean, I think this has come up any number of times talking about the Asian wine market, but those are such specific descriptors, right, to places, right? And I think the opening up of China really drove that point home, that having a descriptor that uses a fruit that's not available in a different market is actually then deeply unhelpful and alienating, right? It makes people feel even more distant from the culture of wine. So the words, for a while, the idea had been maybe we use local descriptors like hawthorn or goji berry or things like that. And that has a place too, I think. But the study that I did, which was a discrete choice experiment where people got to choose between different bundles, it was basically a product page, right? It would say, this wine, I don't know, has a community rating of X, it has the price, it has this origin, and it has these descriptors. And the options that we had two different Chinese fruit descriptors, two different Western fruit descriptors, one that was, I think, generic, was just like red fruit, and one that used, or maybe two, that used evocative descriptors. So like mellow and rounded, or fresh and fruity, things like that. Things that leave, that make you feel something, but leave a lot of room for interpretation. And those were the ones that by far, I think, had the most appeal to consumers. And that was something I had heard anecdotally before, but to have it really suggested strongly by my data was really reassuring. And actually, that's what led into the glassware range that I designed shortly after that, that was really about highlighting those features in wine, right? Because people were strongly drawn to either fresh and fruity or rounded and mellow, right? And that I think almost was something that I identified themselves with.
So you're sort of making the shape of the glasses an extension of what you read and what you saw and what you felt as the response to the survey.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think wine glasses, right? We've known for a long time that the wine glass that you serve the wine in has a huge impact on the way that it tastes and smells and everything.
Certainly.
I think Riedel have led the way in terms of making people aware of those differences. The place where I think I diverge a little bit with Riedel's approach is that they're very much about saying, this is the perfect glass for Zinfandel. This is the perfect glass for Sangiovese, right? And I think not only in an Asian context, where a lot of us live in cities where you just do not have that kind of storage, I thought was impractical. But also, I think implies that there is one way to enjoy. It comes back to what you were saying before, that there is one way to enjoy any particular grape variety, which I just do not think is true. I think it's so much more important that what you drink is giving you the experience that you want, right? You paid the money for the wine, you should get what you want out of it.
Absolutely.
And so the glasses are designed to shape the experience to your preferences. And so the rubric that, or the thought, rule of thumb that we used, I guess, was the idea of the elements, right? Because that is such a sort of Eastern but also Western concept, right? We have an ancient Greek philosophy that had this idea of the natural elements. We have Ayurveda, we have in traditional Chinese medicine, which by extension is in Korean medicine. This idea of the elements. Obviously, everybody has different ideas of what those elements are and what they signify. So there's a little bit of wiggle room in there. But
Well, they, yeah,
basically,
you're right.
yeah,
They
the
did use
idea.
that during the medieval times as well, how they
Exactly.
would
Yeah, for
drink
human health.
and what they would eat. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and it felt like a very natural way of thinking about wine and wine enjoyment. So much so that I was really surprised that nobody had used it before, at least at that point when we looked into it. But so yeah, we have five glasses in the range. Each one is named after a natural element. So air, earth, water, fire, and gold, which is the one for sweet wine or
Gold,
sparkling
not
wine.
wind. Okay.
No, exactly, because there are different ones. There's ether, yeah, different
Okay.
ones depending on which you look at.
At least 80% on the sort of Asian type of thinking, but Well, the scholars, if you go back to the medieval times, the Western sense of medicine was based on what you eat is medicinal. So very much in line with Asian thought at that time. I want to move on now to the millennial generation, the wine drinkers in Hong Kong. And I know you've had extensive experience there. You were born there, you grew up there. You worked with Deborah Myberg, a friend of mine as well. And here's the question: are they still focused on just the big brands and they're wanting to show their status, or have they diversified from what I think are self-imposed limitations?
Yeah, I think I should caveat this, that the people I'm hanging out with are interested in wine, right? So it's perhaps a slightly skewed view. But having said that, I do think there is a much broader group of millennials who've developed an interest in wine within the last 10 years. I think when the tax first came off wine, so more like 15 years ago, it was really about people who were already collecting. Or there was the sort of gold rush element, right? And it was about investing and making a huge amount of money off of Class Growth Bordeaux and sort of speculative market. And I think that was not something in which millennials, who at the time had just graduated from college, a lot of us really had that much ability to play in. I knew some people who are working in finance who are maybe, doing the buy one, sell one strategy with their wine, but it was still, that was still an era that was very much tied to big brands because it was about investment, right? Which inherently is more suited to the big brands. Now, I think the way that people derive their status about wine is really about being an insider, right? So it's like, oh, I found out about this new grower champagne. There's a level of geekiness that I think is delightful and happened. I saw happen in a lot of different markets. I was involved with the New York market while I was at university. I interned at an importer in New York. And then the UK market while I was studying the MW, I was in London a lot. I think there wasn't that same level of confidence that people had where they felt like they could be that person to introduce a new brand to their friends. And now if anything, it's switched, right? And people really feel like if they're not out there discovering new things, they're kind of falling behind. They're not real wine enthusiasts. So that manifests in different ways, right? I talked about grower champagne, but then there's also the Burgundy thing, right? Burgundy has gotten so expensive now that I think if you're just buying the big brands, you look like you don't know what you're doing, right? You don't know how to find a deal. So there is that desire to say, oh, this guy I know, he used to work for. He used to work for Jeremy Sayce at Duchac, right? And now he's starting his own demand. That's sort of where the credibility comes from. As well as another angle of that, I think, would be natural wine, which is more affordable, but definitely it's that crowd, the crowd that would have been drinking craft beer maybe five, 10 years ago, they've very much embraced natural wine.
Now I'm gonna come back to this because I think that the market, if we even said 6, 7 years ago, prior to the, let's say, the bump in the road with the Australian wine issue, China was a huge growing market, which has now significantly declined. But let me get back to that. I think what's more important, how do you manage to balance your life? You've got a husband, you've got children, and it requires an enormous amount of time and dedication to a family. And yet your work requirements are also equally as demanding. I think the viewers would love to hear how you do it.
Thank you. That's a very good question. In fact, I had my son the same year that I passed the Master of Wine. So, in effect, this whole phase of my career has been very much a balancing act and trying to figure out how all of the pieces fit together. I have sort of recurring nightmares about the last month that I was trying to turn in my research paper. My son had just been born. I was still feeding him, obviously. He was a month old. And then I got an email about a month before the research paper was due, saying, are you sure that all the statistics in this paper work the way that you think they do, from my advisor? And I dug into it a little bit and realized that he was absolutely right. There are all kinds of issues with the statistics.
Okay.
I'm not a statistician, but it was apparent to me even. So it was just a month of panicked rewriting and trying, the conclusions had to be changed and everything. And my poor husband was there desperately trying to keep this little baby who needed to be fed every hour or so, from losing his mind. So, and it's kind of been like that ever since. My husband is incredibly supportive,
Well, you
has
look
always been.
remarkably
I'm very lucky.
calm. You know, Sarah, and I think that must be part of the artistic flair that you have. So moving on to that, just listening to the way you describe the type of work that you've done with the glassware and your painting, share with us about your paintings, because that's quite an extraordinary horizon that you sort of pair up. Just share with us.
Thank you. So I was studying, I was studying painting at university when I took time off and sort of went off in this wine direction. Obviously that then thankfully got my degree in the end, or my parents would be much less happy with me than they are today. But as a result, I had this idea that I would be able to use wine sort of as my day job. And have my paintings still going on in the background. But that was very much predicated on my staying in the New York area where I was for university, or the tri-state area anyway. And then between university, or right after I graduated, I had an accident working at a winery. So I fell into a
You broke your
concrete
spine.
vat. Yes, I fell into a vat, broke my spine, and I was kind of at loose ends. I knew I needed to go back home to Hong Kong to recover. But the Hong Kong art market at that point was very much not aligned with the kind of work that I was making at the time. I was doing a lot of performance art and installation. It was very non-commercial, and there were just I had a couple of meetings at galleries where people would just look at me blankly and say, "Well, what are we going to sell? What are we going to sell from this?" I kind of kept it as an interest in the background. I wasn't making art, but I was still, reading about it, trying to keep up. And after I got the Master of Wine, I thought to myself, okay, I have all of these various projects that I've signed up to do, kind of from people approaching me, frankly. It was very, very fortunate timing. There was a lot of enthusiasm around wine in Hong Kong. And I think around my being the first Hong Kong born person, I think there's a wonderful like groundswelling of pride, which I just am immensely grateful
Of
for. But I thought I want something that's just me, right? That I've just decided to do on my own, and it won't be big or commercial. It's not going to be something that I spend a huge amount of time or investment on, but it will be mine. And so I started making these little digital collages that were my visual interpretation of my experiences tasting different wines. And they were very quick and easy to begin with, and very sort of shorthand almost. I was posting them on Instagram, and people really responded to them. I think because of a sense of dissatisfaction with wine reviewing, just to come back to a topic
Oh,
we
yeah,
were
of
discussing
course.
earlier, that people want something more evocative, more emotion driven, more subjective, actually,
More
to latch
stimulating.
onto. Thank
More
you.
stimulating.
Thank you. I wasn't going to say, but you. Thank you. Thank you. So I built that up, and gradually I was approached by various people wanting to collaborate, looking for different ways that we could sort of make something more out of the project. And I really probably the thing that took me to the next step, or permitted me to spend more time on it, was at the very beginning of the pandemic. I was introduced to a man, Raimondo Romani, of Gelasini Romani, who has an Italian wine auction house. And he was doing a wine auction to raise money for, well, sorry, I wanted to create the pieces to raise money for the Italian Red Cross. at the time. And so we agreed to do a collaboration where he would put together ideal provenance lots, right? So sourced directly from the wineries, and I would create images based on those. There were digital paintings. We created limited edition prints, and we sold them as a bundle. So that, so it sort of brought me to the attention of a number of major wine producers in Italy: Biondi Santi, Aldo Quinterno, Sassicaia. I mean, so we had just an incredible array of wines for that
So
event.
talking
And
about that, you now have encapsulated your arts, your wine, your motherhood, the wife, everything together. Quite fascinating.
thank you.
Yeah,
Thank you.
remarkable. Now, I want to move on here, Sarah, because I want to use that as a foundation. You were interviewed by Tatler, and you stated you're definitely not the mold that many see as a master of wine, much older, typically male, Caucasian, if I may add. Do you feel the Chinese have a word for it, yin fen, right? Okay, sort of fate, destiny. Do you feel that fate may have given you this platform to ignite change in the wine world? And what's the reason for your answer?
I would love to take credit for being a voice for change in the wine industry. And I really
Sometimes it's thrust upon you unknowingly.
thank you. I do try to be supportive of other women in the wine industry. I know there's a sense in a lot of industries that the women who do get to the top then pull the ladder up behind them, right, and don't do their part to support others. And I think the reason why I think I was reasonably confident I would not be one of fitting that stereotype is that I was brought, I was raised up by the women who came before me. As you mentioned before, I worked with Deborah Myberg, who was one of the first masters of wine in Asia. And in fact, all of our masters of wine in Asia at that point were women.
A woman.
Yeah, and she was incredibly supportive, always has been, of other women as well. And so there was always a sense, if you do get ahead, you need to help bring others along with you. That's a critical part of it. I think there's a fear among a lot of people, like that their specialness comes from being the only one, right? And that would be eroded
But there's a
somehow.
difference, Sarah. There's a difference. You have Asian blood in you, and you are looked at in a totally different perspective, with all due respect to the other MWs, that lady MWs in Asia. That's got to give you that edge.
Well, so I mean, as I mentioned before, I definitely got a lot of support, I think, from the Hong Kong community, especially from having been raised in Hong Kong and sort of made in Hong Kong, which is something that has inspired a lot of pride, certainly in Hong Kong. But I think I see myself maybe as a little bit more emblematic of where the market is, rather than that I was the one pushing for change. In Hong Kong, in Asia, there have been a lot of female professionals in the wine industry, I think proportionate to in other countries. And partly that is because it is a newer market, right? So what we were mentioning about the MW before, the reason why there are so many older men, white, as it were, obviously, is because it was an English institution, right? It was started in the 1950s. It was started for English merchants. Those were kind of the only people who were in that position, right? And so actually, if you look at the student population now, it's very even, if anything, skewed a little bit towards women. There is, among the younger generations, I think, a less of a sense that they're not welcome at the table. Now, that's very different in different areas of the market. I'd say unfortunately, there are some kind of stereotypical divisions that remain, right? There are a lot more women in marketing than there are in sales, for instance. There are still, if you looked at winemaking, right, there's still a heavy imbalance towards male winemakers, sommelier. There are reasons for that, right? Like winemaking is very physical, right? And
It
I'm not
is.
saying that women can't handle that, but we're socialized generally to think that men are the ones who do the heavy lifting, right? And women, yeah. But I think.
I've been through a lot of harvests with women, and they really are able to pull their weight as well. But honestly, it is backbreaking work, and it can be quite savagely painful, the next day, when you sort of get.
Yeah,
So,
absolutely.
talking about that, Sarah, part of the profession, moving on to the bottle, the final product, part of the professional services you offer include wine consulting. Now, given your location in Hong Kong and the plummeting wine imports into China, and as a result, what sort of advice would you offer a potential wine exporter to this market? Say between the next 3 to 5 year window.
So, a winery wanting to export their wine to Hong Kong or China?
I would say, yeah, it's two different markets.
Yeah, exactly. That was a point I was going to make. Hong
Yeah.
Kong is so small and premium, right? It's really focused on collectible wine and ultra premium wine. And I think there was a big disappointment among producers at the very beginning of 2008 to say 2010 or 11, before there was the real crackdown, right, on the mainland market, there was this real idea that Hong Kong was going to become a huge market, and it affected everybody, both the top end, but also mass market producers who thought they could be selling containers of their wine into the supermarkets in Hong Kong, and that simply was never the case. The Hong Kong population, the people who drink, the population that drinks is this tiny sliver, and they drink very heavily, right? So if you look at the per capita consumption, at one point it was like 5 liters per capita, but I would say that was probably like 100 liters for the people who were drinking a lot, and then virtually nothing for everyone else. Whereas China certainly has that, but I think it's different, and there are areas where you could sell more volume. The challenge, having worked in the sort of volume space in the Chinese market, is there's just a huge amount that's in the market. As you mentioned, imports plummeted, and there's a lot of stock sitting on shelves. So it's a really challenging time to think about entering the market. If I were going to do it, I would exclusively look at working with somebody who has relationships with a sustainable market that's not built around gifting, that's not built around specific events, but that's maybe driven by food and beverage, like wine bistros, become a new sort of consumption location, right? For a lot of younger people, especially, that I think was not the case 10 years ago. And so, yeah, I would be looking to work in that kind of upper end of mid-market range, where there is a real customer. It's not about stockpiling and hoping that you're going to make a big sale at some point.
So right now, it's still rather nebulous in an unchanged in a changing environment that doesn't offer much stability, from the sounds of it. And I think it's not only applicable to wine, but to many other industries,
Absolutely.
certainly around on a global scale. Now, Sarah, you've scaled the summits of many distinct aspects of life, from art to wine, education. Where to next?
Oh, thank you. I mean, I think for me, it's about continuing with what I've started. I think the first few years of being a master of wine was there were so many diverse opportunities, and my husband has been saying to me for years, you need to narrow, you need to focus, right? You need to just double down on the things that you're doing. So, Italy has been my area of focus, sort of from the beginning of my career. Actually, before I got into wine, I spent time in Italy working as a cook at a restaurant. So,
That was quite
spending more time
fascinating.
in
Yeah, I was listening to
Italy.
the other interviews. Yeah.
Thank you. It was a very eye-opening time and wonderful. And just I've never quite gotten over my love of the country.
The
And
Italians are remarkable people. I mean, they're the descendants of the Roman Empire. I mean, a thousand year empire. Remarkable. So many things that they've done, whether it's in fashion, cars, wine. It's just life, la dolce vita,
Absolutely. And it's the things that keep me coming back to Italy are the same things that keep people coming back to wine, but just more of them, right? There's more history, there are more grape varieties, there's more different cuisines, right? It's so incredibly rich that I don't feel like by limiting myself to Italy, I'm limiting myself at all. Right? So it's that's been wonderful, being able to spend more time, invest more time in one region.
So you're now in northwest of the US on an island just east of Seattle. Do you see yourself traveling much?
So I do travel a lot actually too, which
Still?
is yes, yeah, which is one of the challenges for my husband, for my kids. I've been very lucky in that my family, who live in Hong Kong most of the time, have managed to come here for several months at a time, and so they hold down the fort while I'm able to go to Europe. So last year I was maybe 8 weeks in Italy. This year I'll be in Italy a bunch, but actually we're planning to try to do some family travel in Italy as well. My son is so
Beautiful.
excited. So
Beautiful.
excited. Yeah. So it's certainly a puzzle. I mean, I think the challenge for me is that because I'm not working so much in this market at the moment, the way that I was in Hong Kong, where I was doing
Sure.
events and I was writing for local publication, it is certainly more to juggle. But the flip side of that is that when I am here, it's like being on a retreat, and it's really been very helpful for both writing and painting.
Course.
Painting was really challenging when I was in Hong Kong, partly because of space, but also just there are three events every day that you could and maybe should be going to, and that's very much a different scenario here.
So one of the things that my book on etiquette was launched last year. So it's called Master the Art of Manners. And in the book I mention because wine, good food, convivial company, it's all part of the etiquette fabric. And you
Absolutely.
mentioned, I think it was with bestwine.com or one of the interviews, one of the things that you found perhaps quite irritating was when you were with your husband, that always the sommelier would automatically tend to at least go to your husband first to ask them about the wine. What's your advice to woman in that case?
I think to be lighthearted about it, there really is no point in getting into a tense confrontation with people, I think, ever, if it can be avoided.
Of course.
But just playfully, I try to take the list from him and say, "It's my turn today," or something like that, so that the person who did it isn't embarrassed, but they should get the message. The one that irritates me is when it's the same person brings him the list, I take it, I order, they check with him. Then when they bring the bottle, they show him the bottle and pour it to him. Now I want to give people the benefit of the doubt and say it's just, they're just rushed. They're serving a lot of tables. They forgot, right, that I was the one who ordered it. But at a certain point you start taking it personally, right? It's like
We're all
I
human. We're all human.
but I don't know. I think always to try to avoid thinking that it's a personal attack and think, well, the
Course, of
person
course. I mean,
just.
I don't think anybody wants to go there. And having that aggravation at the beginning of a meal certainly doesn't give a good sense, and it's not a good start for an evening, to have
No.
that, of course. Now, my last question, Sarah, for this interview, and thank you very much. You've been such a wonderful guest. When
Well,
one
thank you.
mentions Michelangelo, you only need to think of many, but certainly the Sistine Chapel. Hugh Johnson, you'd think of his series, The History of Wine, and his wine reports. So I know you're at the beginning, but say at the end of your career and say 5 decades hence, how would you like to be remembered?
Wow. I love the question. It's good to have ambition, right? The area that I think I'm doing something a little bit different, right? And that could become a
Absolutely.
mark that I'd like to leave on the world is around elevating the way that we think about wine to beyond being sort of a consumable, like just a beverage, right? Moving it on to being something that is worthy of contemplation, right? Along the lines of art. I think there's a little bit of it's a little bit boring, the idea of saying, everything is art in a way that like kind of like
But
the
that
little
is
boy
true, though. It is art.
the Incredible says, if everybody is special, then nobody is. But I mean, I think there are wines that are art, right? I think there are wines that are worthy of being called art. Not every, your Yellowtail, right? That is a beverage. It's enjoyable, it's making people happy. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But there are wines that are art, and I would like to bring people's attention to that by if that is by making art in reaction to that art. I think that's that could be the a way that I would contribute. So I'd like to see where it leads me. Continuing to sort of be indulged in this project of really contemplating what wine means for us as individuals, but also as cultures, as society as a whole.
Well, Sarah, the world is your canvas. Your words, actions, art, tasting skills are your strokes and the paints that you'll use to enlighten, brighten, and really bring to the fore for this generation, current generations, and future generations. Wish you all the best in your endeavors. And thank you for coming on to the Obuasi Wine Buzz. You've been a remarkably great guest of ours, and thank you for that.
Thank you.
Are you tired of making social mistakes every month, every week, and every day? You're guilty of bad manners and bad etiquette and don't know how to correct them? Well, my latest book, Master the Art of Manners, offers you priceless tips and practical suggestions for everyday situations, whether for business or pleasure. So get your copy today and stop feeling awkward. Don't forget to subscribe, share, and comment on our buzz. That way, you'll always be up to date with our latest episodes and discover the latest happenings in the world of wine. Additionally, we have something extra special for you. We now have the podcast show notes all summarized and available for you.